Hi there. You're listening to Lunch on Monday. Thanks so much for joining us at the table. This podcast is a candid conversation between two friends trying to make sense of current events around the world. These conversations aim to leave us with more questions than answers. We hope that Lunch on Monday will give you something to chew on for the rest of the week. Hello again, I'm Lizette.
And I'm Caitlin.
And we're on episode 4 of Lunch on Monday.
All right. In this episode, we're going to be discussing racism in Europe and what that looks like. But as always, each episode is going to feature a story on current events and just questions we're thinking about from that story, as well as some extra resources. You can always check out our resources in the show notes. Just scroll down and please feel free to pause and come back here and read those first if you'd like to. But before we dive in today, a very important order of business.
I need to know what we had for lunch today. Yes!
We had some curry.
Oh my word, it was so good, friends. Caitlin finally got her chance to cook us lunch on Monday, and it was delicious. It was like a veggie lentil curry with rice. Absolutely delicious. So I feel very pleased that one Caitlin Ball whipped this up for us. It was delightful.
I'm glad I got to feed you. Great. So we're going to just start off talking about some pieces that we pulled from a theater called the Bush Theater in London. And they created a series of pieces called The Protest, and you can find them on YouTube. The first one we wanted to talk about was a piece called You Just Don't Get It and It Hurts.
Hmm.
Yeah.
It was a really good piece, the way that they structured it. So if you haven't seen it, it's essentially a recorded phone screen and you see a text conversation between a white friend and a black friend and what ensues in that conversation.
Yeah, they're going back and forth with the black friend discussing why it felt hurtful at a mostly white party that this other friend was at, the white friend was at as well, that the white guest all said the N-word when a song came on with it. And it's really a painful conversation to watch unfold. Just watching the white friend, like, be defensive over and over again, not understand what her black friend is saying, or not, like, accept it humbly.
Yeah, and I think it's so hard, because I think what I found super impactful about that piece is it's so relatable. It's like, I'm watching this conversation happen and be like, I know, friends, I have had this conversation myself. And I think that was one thing, sort of when you're watching real time, this conversation, something that feels so real and impactful. But you were saying the end really stood out to you of the...
It was at the end, the white friend is like, let's hang out, you know, let's hang out tomorrow or today. Like, can you do that?
And also the white friend says, she's like, let's not talk about anything heavy or politics or have to discuss or debate. Let's just hang out and have fun.
And so you see like the black friends like texting back. And at first she says, not sure I have the capacity, like, and is about to write more, and then deletes it and ends up writing like, oh, I can't today, maybe next week. And it was just like, it was a bit of an eye-opening moment where, like you said, like, I've had these conversations where I have been the white friend who's just so ignorant and so out of it, and not even realizing, like, the weight that puts on my black and brown friends and, like, what it makes them feel when I don't understand.
Yeah, and I think at the end she says, doesn't she, where she's like, the white friend's like, I'm just getting this really chaotic energy from you. You need to just, like, rest, take care of yourself. And really the point that, you know, you and I were discussing is that actually this conversation is literally like crystal clear privilege right out working itself in front of you. The fact that, you know, let's have fun, let's enjoy, let's hang out, when actually, you know, a black friend may not have that luxury. Maybe their mental health is being affected by this and is not necessary. It's a luxury to be able to turn that off. And I think when our black friends are saying we need to take time off or we need to look after ourselves, that's like a protective strategy. It's not like a luxury that we get a chance to switch on and switch off from the conversation. And then the same thing, like you said, of like just the capacity or in the text conversation, the white friend says, oh, this is such a good debate. Like, and again, like, to be fair. I'm putting my own flavor on how I read the text, so apologies if that was not how it was intended. But again, it's just like making so light of someone's actual lived experience. And that's the thing that really lands for me at the end of this piece, where you're like, this friend can't choose to not be black. She can't choose that. And so it's just the struggle that you see of, you know, this nonchalant approach from the white friend, but also the reality that the black friend can't walk away from her identity, and not being willing to engage in that conversation, yeah, is really the part that ends up hurting at the end, where you're like, this is such a simple, seemingly simple conversation to have, but actually ends up being really hurtful, which is so challenging.
Super painful. And a lot of the pieces talked about like the emotion and the pain of that, like, the black artists were going through. And one of the pieces called Do You Hear Us Now just talked about having, like, feeling the pressure, like, all this rage and anger and pain is there, but feeling like she had to turn that pain into something beautiful for it to be accepted.
Yeah. Or she says, yeah, like, it has to be, like, articulate or poetic. And essentially what we're saying is that it has to be something else. Like, it can't be anger or pain or trauma. It has to be poetry or art or something different, which is an interesting thought coming from actually like an artistic expression birthed from personal lived experiences that the Bush Theatre has done in this protest series. But I find that so challenging that actually we can't. Yeah, it's again, black people are not afforded the luxury of just being able to live in the raw emotions of everything that's happening, and the lament and the pain and the difficulty and the anger. It's all of a sudden this challenge to try and find a way, which I think is well-intentioned, because the whole point is, if I can turn this into art, and this goes back to the episode on stories that we were talking about, is if I can leave a voice for a future generation to stand on or to hear my experience, that's a win for everyone. But again, it's an additional burden we're putting on black people, that then we need to be the ones who carry these beautiful poetic stories. And yeah, I've seen so many comments on social media recently of marketing campaigns of, like, you know, corporate companies, and this one woman was saying, you know, stop marketing our pain and trauma, like using social awareness or, you know, civil rights awareness as a way to draw in a different consumer market, which is so painful to see. But again, it's just this commodification of someone's raw emotion and just not having the luxury to be able to, yeah, just live through that experience or process that pain in whichever way you need to.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's, like, you hear the stereotype, like the angry black woman.
Yes.
And, like, people not wanting to be seen that way,
mm-hmm.
Or just thinking that, like, their anger, people perceive their anger as dangerous.
Yeah, and I mean, I think Michelle Obama combated that a lot, when Barack Obama was leading up to his inauguration in the White House, and even afterwards. Yeah, it's definitely seeing this media narrative around that and capitalizing on that narrative, like you said.
Check out her documentary on Netflix. It's so good.
So good. Becoming. So good. Also, the soundtrack to that documentary is flames. Would highly recommend. I was like, yes, Michelle Obama listening to Drake. Okay. I was enjoying it.
Yes. Jamming. Okay, so here's some food for thought just from that. Like, why does the majority culture thinks it gets to set the parameters for appropriate and inappropriate ways for people to express their anger and grief?
Yeah, I think it's essentially saying you can experience anger, but this much. You can experience pain, but this much. And again, we've also seen that, I mean, this has also been making the rounds on social media, which is protesting and who gets to say what protesting looks like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Colin Kaepernick takes a knee, it's not okay. When civil disobedience is the action, it's not okay. When it's looting or rioting, it's not okay. So actually, what is okay? And I think it's just this constant moving of the goalpost by white people and people in positions of privilege and power to, yeah, constantly move the goalpost. And it's essentially a way of keeping you from winning. Like, the whole point of moving the goalpost is to say, there's actually no win for you in this. And I think
or
that
freedom.
Yeah, totally. And I think it comes from a threat or perceived threat to this lack of resources or lack of opportunity or whatever. It's really a scarcity mindset that is believes there isn't enough for all of us. So if you had equal opportunity and if you had the same access that I do, then there would be less for me, as opposed to realizing that, you know, a just society or flourishing society does exactly that. It provides justice and flourishing for everyone in the community.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing with police brutality. Is what is the right thing or the wrong thing to do? No, I mean, Breonna Taylor was sleeping. So again, you just see it over and over, the goalpost or what is right or what is wrong. That narrative is being so strongly controlled by white people or people in positions of power and privilege that actually weaponizes that narrative in a way that, like I said, is constantly moving the goalpost. So you can never win is essentially the goal.
Yes. There's no winning. There's no free will. There's no, no chance to, to make it your own.
Yeah.
And I think this suppression of emotion reminded me a lot of the next two articles that we were reading. So, or I'm sorry, one podcast episode and one article. We listened to an episode called Je Suis Noir by a podcast called The Stoop. Highly recommend. And also we read an article from The New Yorker named Asa Traoré and the Fight for Black Lives in France. So both of these were really centered on France and the France experience, because this is where we live. So we figured we might know a little bit more.
Mm.
And that sort of suppression of, and like the denial of anything, you know, being wrong. Like, I think what people say even about like people expressing their emotions in a certain way or people protesting in a certain way is like, the thought is like, oh, it's not that bad. Like, they don't have to do that much. Like, they don't need to like go that far because it's not that bad.
Mm.
But it is that bad.
Yeah.
Obviously.
And again, it's just this unhelpful comparison. Like,
yes.
Again, the goal is not less bad. The goal is a free and just society for everyone.
There we go.
And I think realizing, you know, we were talking about this earlier, to say each country and each cultural context will have a different response and different approach to the Black Lives Matter movement. And it's a matter of respecting that and seeing where are the similarities and where is the big, you know, big story arc that's happening globally, but also recognizing, you know, there's differences that happen in each individual cultural context. And the comparison game has been so unfruitful in terms of what it's contributing to the conversation, because, you know, whether France is denying that it's not as bad here or the UK is denying, oh, it's not as bad here as it is in America, surely that's not adding to the conversation. Surely what we need to be talking about is what are we not getting right?
Yes.
And how can we address that in the best way possible that fits our cultural context?
Yes. So what was interesting with these two articles in terms of that is, or I'm sorry, the podcast episode in the article is that they were discussing, like, what is it like in France in terms of race relations? And there's this thought that they discussed, especially in the podcast, about, like, Paris being a post-racial paradise and this sort of
it's like this romanticized notion of this bohemian, free thought, free thinking society that I think Paris has represented specifically, I would say, to intellectuals and artists. I think absolutely it has been sort of the safe haven for that, but not without their own experience of discrimination or challenge or whatever that's looked like in different iterations.
Yeah, here's some quotes about sort of the French So sort of the idea of what the French Republic thinks about this. It says, like, race is not real. Race is a social construct. And then to us, there is no hyphenated reality. So, like, African-American doesn't make sense to them.
Yeah, so you wouldn't hyphenate French with anything else. Right. You're either French or you're not.
But instead of... And Ava, this is an interesting... a police... or the Minister of the Interior said this. He said, I would like for everyone to recall that France is not the United States. He acknowledged that the protesters, like, loud cry against racism, but declined to call the police racist, saying only that they were racist police. And this is in response to a lot of protests happening, and they're centering around a young man called Adama Traore, who was killed several years ago by the police in a very unjust manner, and a very similar manner to George Floyd. So this Minister of the Interior is saying, yeah, I'm not going to call the police racist. Remember, we're not racist like that. We don't even see race, is what the French Republic is saying.
Yeah. And I think France has this... By the way, just a caveat, Caitlin and I are not experts on France, so if you have other thoughts or feedback, please feel free to send them to us.
Yes.
But yeah, this is just our experience and sort of what we've been reading. But... as far as our understanding goes, for the French Republic, this concept of laïcité is very important to them. And essentially what it means is it's this sort of secularism in the sense of, like, the, you know, the divide between the state and the church, which was sort of its roots, but it is outworked in the values of the society, which essentially wants to equalize everyone. Every French citizen is equal, and that's, like, equality is a big value for the French Republic. So discussing or pointing out difference is actually seen as a sort of anti-French Republic
yes.
thing in the sense of it detracts away from this indivisibility of France as a state. So yeah.
Yeah. And yet the issue is that, like, you know, one of, I think the podcast was saying, you know, it says, like, it's that race is invisible, but yet it's thrown at you everywhere you go because people are always asking you, where are you from?
Mm-hmm.
And so, it's just this subtle.
Yeah. Think this special experience. Totally.
Yeah.
And I would say, like, a question that I'm thinking about is actually how helpful is this approach of color blindness, or saying we're all equal, we're all on the same standing foot, because in some ways that overlooks people's individual experience and the individual injustices that Black people face in France. And we were just sort of talking about this idea, and for me, I just can't get away from this thought that laïcité, or this idea of, like, equality, we're all the same, this indivisibility of the French Republic, it favors those for whom it's easier to hide your difference.
Mm.
So we've seen this in terms of the conversation around religion here in France, whereas if you wear a burqa or a hijab, that's a very visible thing, right?
Yes, yes.
Whereas, you know, if you're a Christian or whatever, like, you can wear your cross necklace and hide it under your t-shirt, whatever. So whatever the dominant culture is, it's easier to sort of hide that. Same thing with whiteness. No one is thinking of your difference when mm-hmm. you walk around France. But actually, if your skin color, again, something you can't hide, is constantly pointing out your difference, or is constantly eliciting this question of where are you from, then this very experience of it being a free, equal, colorblind society is immediately negated, because the experience that you're having is very different mm-hmm. to a white person in France, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just been interesting to sort of see this, yes, definitely this romanticism of Paris as the safe haven, but actually in reality they are real injustices, as we've very clearly discussed, that are happening here.
Yeah, there's some really interesting... you were making the point earlier about immigration and race and just how they are really tied together
yeah.
in the European experience.
Yeah, I think Yeah, the immigration conversation can't be excluded from the racism conversation in Europe because of the deep-rooted history of colonialism, of the French Empire, of the British Empire. There's no detaching the two. So often when we have quote-unquote immigration conversations, really what we're having is race conversations, whether we want to acknowledge that or not. And it's a product of its own doing. Like I was saying to you, Caitlin, that Trevor Noah puts it best, where you're saying, you know, you can't go to a country, tell them how great you are, colonize them, make them be like you, and then when you try and come back and visit said colonizing country, then exclude them from the experience. So it, it's just really interesting to sort of explore this idea of migration and nationality. And one thing that we were saying is super interesting here in France is that if both of your parents are migrants, so for example, my parents are from wherever, Swaziland, they move here, but I'm born in France, I am then only entitled to French citizenship when I turn 18.
What?
So for the first 18 years of my life at home, the culture that I'm experiencing is the culture of my parents, although I'm going to school in a very, the schooling system in France is very built upon this idea of laïcité and, you know, equality among students and, you know, sort of wanting to give everyone this equal experience. But ultimately, when I turn 18, then I get French citizenship and overnight then have to have this thought change about identity. And, you know, I grew up my whole life in France, okay, but knowing that my family's cultural context is from somewhere else. And then all of a sudden, overnight, when I'm 18, I can get this French citizenship. So it's just also interesting to see how sort of these different, like, naturalization processes outwork themselves in Europe because of this colonial history. And definitely, like, the point could be argued is the point that you only get your French citizenship when you're 18 is to avoid exactly this thing of people moving to France, having children here to get their papers and then leaving or doing whatever. But actually, again, is a product of colonial history.
Yes.
So there's no escaping that conversation around immigration when we discuss that. And I think something that we've talked about is this real nationalistic rise that we've seen ever since, you know, around sort of 2015, 2016. Yes, in America with the election of Donald Trump, but also here in Europe, there's that's just the reality that more far right conservative parties, like we said, like are dominating sort of the political landscape. And a hot button issue that always comes up in every election is this idea of immigration.
Yeah.
So there's no way to sort of separate those two, I think, particularly here in the European context.
Yeah. And I think you can tell people's positions by their language, right? So the Stoop episode was talking about how people who are seen as are good for society, are called French, versus like they're called African migrants if they're seen as like unsavory or if they're unemployed.
And I think it's just this whole idea of it being merit-based citizenship. Like, if you're a person of color, you have to earn your citizenship, which makes no, or not even a matter of earning it to get it in the first place, but perhaps even defending it and feeling like you need to uphold the quote unquote French values or whatever that looks like. But I think these thoughts about national identity have really been thrown into question of like, what does it mean to be British? What does it mean to be French? You know, and really challenging those questions at the base level. And really is our underlying assumption when we say those is it white? Is that the assumption that we have in the back of our minds? But something that was really interesting, that was an interesting story, is when I was at, in my undergraduate, I took a class called Black France, which was as part of my French, you know, curriculum. And when I was being interviewed for my university here in Paris, they asked me about that class because it was on my transcript. And the class was super fascinating. Basically, we read different texts from Frantz Fanon. We listened to different like black rap music that's come out of like the Parisian banlieue, like all these different things. Super fascinating learning about it because I'd never, again, been taught or learned about this side of French history or French identity, and all of a sudden realizing, oh wow, there's this whole other side that I've never known about. But in my interview here at my university, my interviewers were so skeptical. They were so skeptical. They were like, Black France, what does that even mean? Again, this idea that there's no hyphenated reality right. here in the French Republic. And so for them, they just couldn't understand what the need was to sort of explain this Black side of French history, which I thought was so, I was really taken aback by it, to be honest, because I was so excited to be able to share about this Black France class, which was genuinely one of my favorite classes I took in undergrad, to then all of a sudden be like, oh, you don't even think this should exist as a concept. So that was a really challenging thing to, like, sort of the actual outworking of this conversation that we're discussing.
Yeah, that is challenging.
And I think something, yeah, like I said, in addition to that, we discussed the 1998 French Football World Cup team, that a slogan that people used was sort of Black, Blanc, Beurre. And this idea that, yeah, like it was this very multi-ethnic team that was celebrated. So even though we were willing to like name and glorify that in a sporting context, actually in France, they don't include race or ethnicity in their census. So it's just interesting to see, like, on a sporting context, we're willing to glorify that and use it as this poster child of, look, this is what a united French team looks like, as opposed to, yeah, not being able to acknowledge that. And I will say, like, I didn't know if you had any more thoughts about this idea of how here in France, to call someone Black, you use the English word Black.
Right, right. Like, there's not, yeah, they're trying to use, like, begin to use, like, noir. If you're Black, to describe yourself. But yeah, I think it is interesting that they would use sort of maybe like an American term, I guess.
Yeah. Just in a English, different language. Yeah.
Non-French. It shows just the depth of like the denial.
Yeah. The denial. And I mean, to be honest, I think when people say like they call someone, you know, vous êtes un Black or tu es un Black, like when you say that, I think it's coming from a place of not wanting to offend.
Right.
But similarly, how the Black community in the States, for example, has said, stop calling us people of color. Like, just call out the Black experience in America.
Yeah.
And I think it's a similar thing here where not wanting to use the French word for Black, which has a previous history of being used in a derogatory form, you're seeing sort of the Black community in France re-own that word and choose for themselves actually what they want to be called. And again, it's just this idea that the majority culture doesn't get to determine what people are called.
That's
like
okay.
Actually,
yeah.
It's way more about listening and saying, actually, how do you identify and how can I best listen to that and keep my ears open to actually what it is you're saying.
Yeah, that's great. A quote that I wanted to highlight from that second video from the Bush Theater was just something that I felt like was something that is more hopeful to end on.
Yeah.
She said, marvel, marvel at Blackness, at how we still love, at how we still hold each other up, and find light in our loudness and our boldness and our wit and our humor and our talent. It is like so beautiful to think of just like the beauty and the endurance that's like coming through.
Totally. And I think also, yeah, that endurance and the resilience, to be honest, to see, you know, an empire, the British Empire, like that has for so long used Black and brown bodies to build its wealth, build its sovereignty, build its prowess, still seeing the resilience of Black people in the UK being able to find their voice and continue to live and learn and bring, yeah, even more richness to our society, whether that be through your joy or whether that be through your pain. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something important to keep in mind. You know, it's not trying to hem people in. And maybe, I guess, as just some homework as we sort of wrap things up, is some of the, you know, books and authors that we've been thinking about that we've kind of already mentioned. As we said, as always, they'll be in the show notes if you want to check them out in more detail. But I read a book recently, and so did Caitlin,
yeah.
called British by Afua Hirsch, which is exactly discussing this idea of what is a national identity? What does it mean to be British? And what does the experiences of Black and people and other people of color in the UK look like? So that's more in the sort of UK context. And then maybe more closer to home here in France is, like I said, again, if you're interested, definitely check out France Fanon or Aimé Césaire, who's this amazing poet who his poetry, again, just explores a lot of these similar themes that we've been discussing today.
Yeah, I think that a question that I've had in my head as towards the end of this conversation has been, you know, can we, like, as maybe as a white majority person or the culture or just anyone in general, can we begin to see people of all different races and not make the assumption, oh, you're not from this country or you're not this, you know, you are a certain way. Mm-hmm. I think if that begins to be our if those assumptions begin to be torn down, then we'll have done well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We'll have won.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good thought to end on.
Thanks so much again for joining us at the table for lunch on Monday. Next week will be our last episode of the season, and we'll be discussing race and sports. We'll look at the Netflix series The Last Dance about Michael Jordan and his team, the Bulls. If you have any thoughts or articles on this, please send them to us at lunchonmonday@gmail.com. Or if you just have other contributions or suggested topics, send them our way. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time.